In honor of Father's Day this Sunday, I'm speaking today with Barry McIntosh, the Executive Director of Young Fathers of Santa Fe. McIntosh has taught parent effectiveness for 18 years and sex education here in New Mexico for 12 years. He teaches childbirth preparation, specifically for the coaches and father's role, and is one of the few male doulas, childbirth assistant, in the country. Barry is currently the head of education for Planned Parenthood of New Mexico and is a trainer for the New Mexico Health Training Institute. Welcome to the Radio Cafe, Barry.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it. Somebody's getting a smoothie in the background, aren't they?
Absolutely, absolutely. Welcome. You have a wonderful quote on your website for Young Fathers of Santa Fe by Margaret Mead, and it says, "The most important task of what civilization is to teach its young men how to be fathers."
I know, isn't that amazing?
What does that mean? Can you talk about that?
Well, that's it's a surprising quote, and I think Margaret Mead is quoted so often by so many places, but that's the quote that gets kind of missed and lost. So really, that's our motivation. Why did she say that? Why did she say the most important task of any civilization is to help its young men to be good fathers? Well, the reason is because fatherlessness is so impacting on so many of social ills and social problems. When the father is absent or there's not a healthy male role model, children don't do as well. We know that single mothers do an incredibly difficult job and do it amazingly well, but the one thing they cannot be, and that's a man. They cannot be a man. So we need men in children's lives to show the children how men are. But when they're absent, the results are really devastating. In fact, 63% of youth suicides are from fatherless homes. 85% of all children that exhibit behavioral disorders are from fatherless homes. 80% of rapists motivated with displaced anger come from fatherless homes. 71% of all high school dropouts, come from fatherless homes. 70% of juveniles in state-operated institutions are from fatherless homes. And 85% of all youth sitting in prisons are from fatherless homes. I know, it's devastating.
Terrifying statistics here.
So if we put our energies into one issue, that's healthy fathering, keeping the father involved, we can have an impact on all of these social ills.
So tell us about Young Fathers then. How do you find these fathers and what does it do?
Well, Young Fathers is a relatively new organization, but I've been doing the work with Young Fathers for about 12, 13 years. And I was with an organization called New Mexico Young Fathers Project. Unfortunately, that ran out of funding in 2009, and the office here in Santa Fe was closed up, and I was let go. Nobody else is doing this work, so I started my own organization. And in December 1st, 2009, we started as Young Fathers of Santa Fe. And this is really a very important date for me because it's my father's birthday. And it just happened to be that day. It wasn't planned that way. My last day of work with New Mexico Young Fathers Project was November 30th. The next day, we started with our own organization. And the good thing was that the clients saw absolutely no difference of services.
Wonderful.
So they weren't impacted at all with that. They've got other things to worry about. So what we focus on doing is supporting young men being the fathers that they want to be. The first question we ask these guys is, do you want to be involved in your kid's life in a healthy way? And they, you know, virtually all of them say yes. So how we do that is we have support groups running constantly. We have about 5 support groups every week at the local high schools, at the Teen Parent Center at Santa Fe High, at Early Head Start, Capitol High, and then also at Street Outreach, which is the homeless place for the street kids. And then we also have Las Cumbres in the evening for working fathers. And then we also do a lot of one-on-one activities, case management. And I also go down to the youth detention center and juvenile detention center and meet with the incarcerated fathers down there, usually every couple of weeks.
How old are the majority of these young fathers?
It's a huge wide range of age. And even though we call ourselves young fathers, it's more about experience than age. But over the years, we've dealt with over half a dozen 13-year-olds.
Oh, wow.
Yes. So imagine a 13-year-old. In fact, last year we had a 14-year-old who was still in school, and he came to us. We found out about him because he was referred by the school counselor. And we found out about him. We helped him get a job and helped him participate and be prepared to deal with his partner's parents which sometimes with young guys, they are pushing them away big time. And just help to deal with the relationship and what she's going to go through as a pregnant woman and what he's going to go through, what he's likely to expect, how important it is to stay in school, but also support him on how he wants to be a father. So it's, you know, most of our guys are young, teenagers or in their mid-20s, but some of the guys, we are even working with a 61-year-old grandfather who's got custody of his grandson, who wants to learn parenting skills. Wow. So that he can, you know, do things a little bit differently this time around.
Well, that's encouraging as well. And these young kids, like 13, 14, do they have the psychological wherewithal to understand, really, what's happening?
Well, I think they try to, very much. And when I ask them that question, do you want to be involved in your kid's life in a healthy way? They are very responsible. They say, yes, I want to be a good dad. I don't know how, but I want to. And that's how we help them, the how part.
So once they come to you and they say, yes, I do want to do this, what kind of skills are they given at this point? And how do you convey these skills?
Yeah, we have to meet them where they're at. And where they're at may be, man, I need a job, Barry. That's my biggest priority. So we meet them at the at their highest priority. You know, or, man, I can't see my girlfriend because, you know, her parents won't allow me to even contact. So, okay, so now we need to work on that relationship. So whatever they present with, if we can help them, then we will help them. If we can't, then we refer them out to other agencies in town. But things like communication skills is high, whether it be in a job situation, whether it be in a partner situation, or whether it be a child-parent situation. So we are all communication skills trained. I'm trained in parent effectiveness training. Our other, and so are all of our case managers, but also use nonviolent communication, motivational interviewing, and also circle of security parenting. So we use a lot of different modalities to...
It's a circle of security parenting?
Circle of security. It's a wonderful program. And it's, in fact, one of our funders, Brindle Foundation, who's funding our Father's Day event at the Children's Museum there this Sunday, they sent me for training to learn the skills of, and a lot of other agencies in town. So if we get referrals from another agency, we're talking the same language with the person. So they see a kind of a uniformity, a standard of communication skills. It's wonderful. It's just a great parenting program.
And it sounds like a lot of the effectiveness training that you give is really around communication.
Absolutely.
And about kind of thoughtful communication.
Yes, yes, which gives them an opportunity to break down their kind of reactive communication,
right,
which can lead to abuse, violence, child abuse, and just, you know, whether it be verbal or physical. So they're given strategies on how to express themselves and how to listen as well, which is sometimes a tough thing for young men to do.
Well, absolutely. And given the statistics that you said in the beginning, I assume that a lot of these young teens didn't have male role models or fathers themselves. So they don't even know where to start, do they?
Exactly. That's the thing. I think they're kind of feeling lost, overwhelmed, and in a lot of cases pushed away. And that's the problem. Most guys feel pushed away, and we're trying to just help them get a little bit, you know, and understand, you know, their partner, what she's going through, and maybe their partner's parents, what they're going through. So it's a lot about teaching patience, which is difficult, but it bears results, and they see it from other people. Especially, that's a great thing about group work. You know, we run these groups. One guy is a little bit further ahead than another guy, or a little bit behind. So we don't necessarily, we facilitate the group, but we let the other guy say, well, yeah, this was happening to me, buddy, but, you know, I did this and this worked for me. So they're supporting each other, which is just delightful to see.
And how many young men do you have, or have you served in a year?
Last year we served about 175.
That's amazing.
And we worked actually with a lot of the mothers as well. So in all, we worked about with over 200 young parents.
So you're really supporting entire families, I mean, by helping the male there.
Well, we're focusing on the male, but really we're focusing on the child. You know,
right.
that's our motivation as well. We want him to be a great dad, but we want him to be a great dad so that he raises a great child. You know, so that's our focus.
And this society here is so prone to machismo, and you also have to have kind of training around affection and around kind of gentle touching of children and being affectionate.
Yeah, how that can look and how that can be to meet the child's needs and to meet the parent's needs as well. So we understand that, and it's great. We have three case managers, myself included. We have a bilingual case manager, Gabriel Ortega, who was born in Mexico, and he's raising two children himself. My other colleague, Damon Archuleta, was born and raised in Santa Fe, and he's raising two children. So it's just great. These guys know what they're doing, and it's just great to see these guys. It's very inspirational.
And you've had feedback. I mean, they've gone away, and do you stay in touch with all of these young men as they go through life?
We try to, but it doesn't always happen. But right. just a couple of weeks ago, I had a guy that came back into town after living out of state, and I had completely lost touch with him. He had lost touch with me. He came back into town. And he knew my first name, Barry, and he knew that I worked with young fathers. And he tracked me down through Facebook and tracked us down, and I worked with him 12 years ago. And he wants to come back in and start working again. I said, fantastic.
Now, we should say that one of your largest events of the year is the Father's Day event at the Children's Museum, which will be held this Sunday from 1 to 4. Is that correct?
That's right. Yep. It's at the Children's Museum from 1 to 4. It's totally free. The whole day is free for everyone. We're serving food. Panda Express is providing food. Last year they served 400 meals, so we can handle a big crowd. So come on down. We've got a car show, and we've got some lowrider cars coming, which is I'm really excited about. We've got a school of DJ. Gabriel Ortega, a bilingual case manager, is also a DJ. He has an organization called School of DJ where he trains up guys. And there's going to be young guys spinning in the outside in the lawn. And we have a jumpy house for the younger kids, and we have all the wonderful stuff at the Children's Museum. And we have our funders, and we must mention them and thank them so much for their support, which is the Brindle Fund at the Santa Fe Community Foundation, Santa Fe Boys Fund, and Southwest Care Center. They're all supporting us, and of course Panda Express with the foods, and of course the Santa Fe Children's Museum. So we're going to have a great show. We've also got a graffiti artist who's doing some workshop and interactive stuff. Oh, so wonderful. we want there to be interaction between the kids and the parents and stuff.
Well, I'll say I first learned about you last year, Father's Day, at this event. We were driving by, completely by chance, saw the jumpy house, and my son is like a magnet to jumpy houses. We got out, and it was really interesting because it was a completely different demographic than I'm used to seeing. And here were these young men with children. And I immediately, I think I went up to you and said, who are you and what is this organization? It was incredibly moving to see. But it also reminded me how rarely I do see that.
Well, I think that was one of the reasons that the Children's Museum were very, very encouraging of our participation, because they wanted to reach out to the rest of the community. And they said after that day, they saw so many families that they've never, ever seen before. And that's great. It's a great resource in town. So we want to expose, you know, the whole community to it. So this Father's Day event is for the whole community. Anybody can come down, whether you're a father or the father's not around or whatever. It doesn't matter. Come down, enjoy the day with us, and we'll even feed you.
And it was quite good. I did remember the food as well.
Yeah, Panda Express stuff is great. I love it.
Now, the other thing that struck me when I spoke to you even last year was that you might be considered an unlikely role model. You're an older white guy with this foreign accent, and so imagining you interacting with these young kids is interesting. So how do you connect with them? Because it seems that you do quite effectively.
Well, it's funny. I don't really know how I do it. Actually, I do know how I do it, but it's kind of just remarkable that it does happen. Because as you say, I'm an old white guy. You can't get more whiter than me.
I didn't say the old part. I said white guy. Wait.
I'll include the old part. And that's part of the connection. Mm-hmm. And so very self-deprecating. So they feel comfortable. So vulnerability builds connection. I also use a lot of humor and, you know, joke around with the guys, and it's usually at my expense. So humor breaks down barriers. I also accept the kids where they are. You know, yes, they've got a child on the way. Yes, they're a young person. Yes, they maybe didn't make good family planning decisions, but that's okay. We're meeting them now. And a lot of the guys know me because I go into the schools and I teach sex ed in the schools. So a lot of the guys, oh, yeah, I remember you. And I say, yeah. Well, how come it didn't work, guys? Right. How come you didn't use that condom? So, well, you know, it's comfortable. It's accepting them, and which validates them. And they feel validated. And with that, all of that connection, they just accept me, which is great. And they can't peg me either because I'm not from this culture, I'm not from this area, so they don't know where.
Oh, that's right. It's hard to label. They don't understand the accent.
That's right.
They don't. Well, and it's hard to talk about teen fathers without really talking about the teen pregnancy rate here in New Mexico. Can you address that a little?
Well, we are the number one teen pregnancy in the nation. New Mexico is the number one teen pregnancy in the nation. And so it's a huge problem here. So we do talk actually a lot to our fathers about the next child. One child is going to be really challenging. If you have two children as unplanned and they're close together, the effect on maintaining or keeping you in poverty is huge. That second child is huge. So we really try to make sure that they use good family planning decisions, you know, for the future. And usually they're very, very good. In fact, we train the guys up to be community health workers, promotores, so that they go out in the community, talk to their friends. In fact, I got a phone call just the other day and said, you know, a buddy of mine had an accident. Where can he get plan B? So, okay, we'll let him know and tell him how to do that. So they're reaching out into the community, and they're our eyes and ears with their brothers and sisters and nieces and nephews and cousins and whatever, and so that the information can get out.
And according to them, is it a lack of education or is it a lack of desire? I mean, what is the source, really, of all of these pregnancies?
Well, I think there's a whole different, there's a lot of different things. Poverty is huge. Right. Poverty is a huge indicator. But also, if you're the child of a teen parent, you're more likely to be a teen parent. If you have a sibling that's a teen parent, you're more likely to be a teen parent. If you live in New Mexico, you're more likely to be a teen parent. So you've got lots of different factors. So, but it is access to health care. It's good, accurate, healthy information, which that's what we do in the schools, and so that they feel comfortable accessing this and they feel comfortable talking about it and treating sexuality as if it was normal, which it kind of is.
Well, it is, but you wouldn't know it in this puritanical culture, would we?
Yes,
and
that's correct.
And I think there really is, I mean, this whole idea of abstinence, and we don't need to get into all of the various ideas about sex education, but it really is important in this state, and it seems that, or in this country, it seems that if we could really expand education, that it would take care of a lot of problems, not just in terms of teen pregnancies, but really access to accurate education is lacking on so many different levels.
Well, I think if we look at places that are very successful, let's have a look at the Netherlands. They treat sexuality as if it's normal. There's a national conversation about it. There are national norms about it, like no sex unless it's safe sex. And parents talk to kids, and kids talk to parents. And in fact, they are almost 2 years later in their first ever sexual experience. Yet they're talking about it from a very early age. So talking about it is actually protection. It doesn't encourage. And I think that's a misunderstanding that a lot of our society here has. You know, we shouldn't be talking about it. We shouldn't be showing them how to use condoms. We shouldn't be talking about birth control, how it works and stuff. You know, actually we should be. That's exactly what we should be doing. And we should have a national conversation about it. So
if in the Netherlands there is this correlation between talking about it earlier and sexual activity later, is there also the other correlation with no sex education or abstinence education and higher teen pregnancy rates?
Yeah, in fact, some of the studies have actually shown that abstinence-only education, you know, it doesn't work because it works great if you're abstinent, but as soon as you start having sex, the message has been that, you know, condoms don't work and birth control don't work, so I'm not going to bother using it, which is, that's just wrong. It's misinformation. So, you know, whenever I go into the classroom, I usually ask the kids, you know, hands up everyone who's planning on having sex sometime during your lifetime. Guess what? They all put their hands up. And I said, this is information you can use for the rest of your life. Maybe not this year, maybe not next year, but at some point, you will.
Wonderful. So that they can at least have that.
Yeah. And it normalizes things, too.
So do you, what in your view does it take to be a good father? And we should say you are a father and a grandfather.
Yep. I'm a father of two daughters and I'm grandfather of four kids, and it's wonderful. Really, I think it's opening up yourself to the availability of having these children teach you what's going on. And you really need to be present. Presence is the thing. And I ask the guys, what kind of father do you want to be? And they say the normal things like, I want to provide for my children. I want to protect my children. So for fathers, providing for protect is very important. But also, they want to spend time with them. Because they know if they weren't spend time with their father, They want that to happen to their kids. And that's a great motivator. And I tell the guys, you know, young children spell the word love, T-I-M-E. It's all about time. If they are worth spending time with, then they feel validated and they're worth, and they feel loved. So it's really simple, just quality, good timing with them. Spend as much time with them. That's why we want this Father's Day, we want it to be interactive. It's not just something that you go to, it's something that you actually participate in. And I have got a wonderful photograph from last year. There's this guy sitting very quietly and his daughter is painting his face. And it's great. I'm sure she's putting rainbows and unicorns on his face. And he's just sitting there being very patient. And I'm sure he's thinking, oh my goodness, you know, if my buddies could see me now.
Well, this is certainly lessons for fathers at any age, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, we've kind of lost connection with each other, mothers and fathers, actually, yes. With technology, with everything. And sometimes it's good to be reminded that just spending time and being present is so valuable, yes. And such a gift to give anyone you're with.
Yeah. Yeah, your time, man. Everybody's time is valuable, but if we can spend time with our children, then they know that they are worth it.
Can you share with us just a few anecdotes of some of the kids that you've met? And I say kids because 13, my gosh, I'm still getting over that age, but
yeah.
Some anecdotes of experiences you've had over the years.
Well, it was interesting. I think it was last Father's Day, just before Father's Day, I went into the juvenile detention center, and I asked this... And the group of guys, and I asked them, imagine 10 years from now, your child is 10 years old, 12 years old, whatever. What would you like your child to say to you as, you know, for Father's Day? And this one guy said, you know, oh, well, I want my kid to say that I was a good soldier on the street, that I got respect. And there was a lot of this gang talk, and it was kind of scary to me, but I let him go through it. He said, yeah, I want to be, you know, seen as a strong guy, you know, that I represented the neighborhood well. And I said, okay. So, and I didn't say anything. I just said, so you also want to be there for your kid? And he went, yeah, I want to be there for my kid. And I said, so is your behavior getting you what you want? And he was incarcerated at the time. We were in the juvenile detention. And he didn't say anything. The next week I came back in, and he didn't really share much in group. But at the end of the group, he came up to me and said, so Barry, you said something last week. If my behavior doesn't get me what I want, what do I need to do that does get me what I want? I said, okay, now we can start working together. And it was great to see that light go on. He realized that his gang activity was actually taking him away from his child. And in fact, a lot of guys can see that as a way of maybe reducing their gang activity, because the gang actually respects family. And if you're saying, no, I can't do this because I need to take care of my family, there's an honor and respect for that. So... great.
Oh, what a touching story there. Any others?
I could go on forever. It's just wonderful to see the guys, you know, really be motivated by their children and want to do the absolute right thing. We've got a video on our website, which is youngfathersofsantafe.org, and there's four guys telling their stories. And one guy is talking about being pushed away by his girlfriend, being pushed away by her parents, being pushed away by everybody, and then him just saying, hey, you just got to hang in there. It just makes me actually hang in there more and more and more. Everybody wants me out. Nope, but darn it, I'm going to get in there. And he, in fact, his girlfriend, they split up, and she moved away, and he was the primary caregiver for a year in his child's life. And it was just so great, so great. He really stepped up.
And it worked out?
Yes, yes. And now they've actually got a much better relationship. They're still not together, but they're dealing as co-parenting and doing very well.
That is a fantastic story. How much would you like to expand? I mean, reaching 170 parents. I mean, here I think on your website you say there are 4,500 barista women ages 15 to 19.
Actually, the latest numbers are even more than that right now. But yeah.
Oh boy, okay.
So there's room to expand into the rest of the state, and I do help other organizations elsewhere in the state start up programs or support their programs. But I think, you know, there's into the country. There's opportunities, and you know, we've learned kind of the hard way over the years. We've made some mistakes, but it's really kind of grassroots stuff, and it's finding guys that are motivated to help other guys, and then it kind of just rolls. And it's man, I get inspired every single day by these guys.
Well, you are an inspiration for sure. So make sure everybody goes this Father's Day to the Children's Museum from 1 to 4.
Yep.
Free food, free entrance, music, a jumpy house. Really open to any and all families. We encourage everyone to go. It's such a beautiful event. I really thank you and honor you for your work.
My pleasure.
Here.
And the Children's Museum is on Old Pecos Trail, just down from Cordova and Old Pecos Trail. And it's easy to see. We'll have banners and a jumpy house, as you noticed,
yes,
driving past.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I'll be speaking with Brian Bird of Wild Earth Guardians about the recent proposal after 30 years to start mining uranium near Mount Taylor. This is Zaylee sitting in for Mary Charlotte. I am speaking with Brian Bird of Wild Earth Guardians, and he is going to tell us a little bit about a recent proposal after 30 years to start mining uranium near Mount Taylor. This apparently is also going to be the largest uranium mine in the U.S. Welcome, Brian, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Zaylee. It's good to be back, although this isn't the happiest of subjects.
How did this come about? Can you tell us about this new proposal?
Well, yeah, it looks as though a Canadian mining company and a Japanese partner want to come into our state and open up the largest uranium mine in a long, long time. And it's on Mount Taylor, down west of Albuquerque. Mount Taylor is a traditional cultural property that was designated in 2009 by the state, which means that it has especially high religious significance and spiritual significance to our Native American population. So this mining company is proposing on public land, this is Forest Service land, it's our land, to pull the uranium out from underground.
Now, we are here today, especially, yeah, because the Forest Service is taking public comments on this project up through today.
That's right.
So they can, under the General Mining Law of 1872, allow any mining company to come in and develop. However, we have to have this impact statement, mm-hmm, and they can reject a quote-unquote unreasonable or illegal plan. So you're here today specifically because of this deadline, correct?
Yeah, we are trying to get our members and everybody out there in the public across the United States to comment against this proposal. So people can write to the U.S. Forest Service at the Cibola National Forest, and I can give you that email address. It's comments-southwestern-cibola, C-I-B-O-L-A, at fs.fed.us. And people have up until 5 o'clock today to write to the foresters and tell them that to not approve the Roca Honda plan of operations. So that's Roca Honda. We want people to tell the Forest Service to choose no action. These are our lands. These are not necessarily lands that are meant to be exploited for unsustainable uranium deposits and frankly dangerous to our health and our society. This is an area of land that's very special to all of us here in New Mexico and across the United States. So tell the Forest Service that you do not want to see uranium mining and that there are higher and better uses for this landscape.
Now, it should be said that people in the area, according to an Albuquerque Journal article, are actually quite in support of it.
Mm-hmm.
The company is offering about 640 construction jobs, mm-hmm, 250 or so directly at the mine. Shouldn't we be happy about economic development in the state at a time when there really is very little?
Well, of course, any jobs are tempting at this time in history, but this is typical boom and bust cycle. Mining is a boom and bust economy. It's happened over and over in New Mexico. People have come in, dangled a carrot in front of us, and we've jumped up and down and said, oh gosh, look at all these jobs. A company comes in, employs a few people for a short period of time, pollutes our water, pollutes our air, takes out this poison, uranium, that is really just going to end up probably hurting and killing people somewhere on Earth. And we jump up and down, but the fact of the matter is it's boom and bust. These jobs will be gone faster than they came, and we'll be left with the pollution to clean up here in New Mexico.
And we used to have a lot of uranium mining here, and
yeah,
I know that there was a very high incidence, especially in the Navajo Nation in Arizona, but also in Crown Point, very high incidence of cancer.
Yeah.
So there's been legal processes, and in 2005, I believe, the Navajo Nation even declared a moratorium on,
yeah,
uranium mining. So what does this company propose in terms of safety standards at this point? Have we gotten better? Should we still be worried about this?
Well, they are claiming that the technology is advanced and this is safer and it's one of the safest forms of mining. But it's hard to believe them with the legacy that uranium has left in our state and the health issues that have been left behind. We still have sick people that need help. We still have sick lands that need to be cleaned up. And do we want to just continue down that road when we know we've got problems left over from the history of this uranium mining? So, I would argue that it's not worth it. And the value of this land, not only for the spiritual value and just its existence value, Mount Taylor, we can see it from many points around New Mexico. It's one of the sacred points of the Native Americans around here. This has much higher values than a short-term, boom in uranium. Not just the spiritual values, but air quality, water quality. These are lasting services that we depend on in our state.
There's a great quote by Eric Jantz of the New Mexico Environmental Law Center. It is essentially the same as proposing a huge uranium mine in the middle of the Vatican.
I know. I kind of I like that one. And I have sort of alluded to mining under the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. It's a, it really is a sacred spot. And it was named a traditional cultural property, which doesn't come easy to get a traditional cultural property. And unfortunately, our Native American population is having to fight these types of proposals, not just here in New Mexico, but as some people may know, in Flagstaff, there's a proposal to spray treated effluent sewage water on the mountain there for the ski area. And that's been through the courts for years and years and years because the Native Americans see that as a sacrilege of one of their sacred sites. So again, we're seeing the same pattern here. Vulnerable people are being taken advantage of by multinational corporations that, have no boundaries. They operate with no rules in our world. And we need to stand up against this type of tyranny.
Well, again, let's look at the larger issue here, though. It's a question of energy use, right? And uranium would be mined for nuclear energy. Mm-hmm. And there's so much talk coming up now about mini nukes, as if nukes were very cute and could be used. So can you tell me about this larger kind of drive for more energy sources and the price of uranium going through the roof?
Yeah, well, our human population has an insatiable appetite for energy, and we need to figure out ways to live on less energy through conservation and through new technology, not develop new forms of energy that are dangerous to human health. So there is the issue of how do we develop new forms of energy. But from what I understand, if you're a nuclear supporter, there's enough spent uranium already in the world to last a long, long time. If we wanted to go down the nuclear route, we wouldn't have to develop new mines like this at all. But the fact of the matter is we don't need the energy at this time. We have enough intelligence and technology to learn how to live on the energy we have now, hopefully renewable wind and solar.
That would be ideal now, wouldn't it? Especially here in New Mexico where we have is lots of sun and lots of drought.
Sometimes to our disadvantage.
Now, the company also says that this site is one of the highest grade uranium deposits in the U.S. So we're pretty mineral rich here in New Mexico.
Unfortunately, we're sitting on top of some of the best uranium, if there is such a thing. And so it's very attractive to these multinational corporations. And they're going to come in and exploit the people there and people are going to get sick. In our opinion, it's not worth it. This mountain is too sacred. It's too important from an ecological perspective to for short-term gain, basically.
Now, Wild Earth Guardians does a lot of work around different resources, against coal mines, against trapping of lots of animals here. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the other campaigns that you are also working with now?
Well, we have a very full-on campaign right now to save the Mexican wolf. As people have probably heard, unfortunately, the Obama administration under the new Secretary of Interior, Sally Jewell, one of her first actions is going to be to strip the wolf of protections across our country, which is just probably a completely political move. But our wolves here in New Mexico, we do have a population of Mexican wolves. They're struggling to survive. And they are going to retain their protections. And the proposal is to actually expand their recovery area for those wolves. So we're working very hard to protect these wolves through different campaigns, including making cow-free parts of the national forest system so that the wolves can have a place to be wolves. So we've got a Wolf campaign, we've got our Clean Air campaigns, and we've got a major Rio Grande campaign to keep water in the Rio Grande, to keep the Rio Grande wet. So we've got all types of work. And if people are interested in finding out more, we're actually having our annual vegetarian barbecue tonight.
Tonight?
Tonight at our offices at 516 Alto Street. So that's right off of Alameda behind the Santuario de Guadalupe. And if people want to come by and hear more about our campaigns and have some free vegetarian barbecue and a refreshment on us, please come by at 5:30 or 6. We'll be there till about 7:30 barbecuing behind our building.
That sounds great. When you talk about clean air, I know that you've had some legal successes, no? About
yes, our climate and energy program is really making incredible strides right now with the Clean Air Act, basically. We are shutting down coal-fired power plants left and right where they've become unsustainable, including the San Juan Generating Station here in New Mexico in the Four Corners region. We were able to work with other environmental groups, PNM, and we were able to get two of the four boilers shut down there that were polluting our air and water. So we're excited to see that moving along. We're hoping all this work on sort of making coal cost what it really should cost us. In other words, you know, internalizing the external costs of health and pollution, we're going to make solar and wind energy much more attractive economically for development. Because right now, coal is subsidized to such a degree, and all these energy systems are in place that it's very cheap to produce energy that way. But it shouldn't be. It should be costing us a lot more. We're covering it in tax dollars, hidden tax dollars. So anyway, the point is that we're going to try to make solar and wind much more affordable and competitive with our clean air program.
And when we talk about the cost in terms of uranium mines as well, are there a lot of external costs
of
there
course.
In terms of health?
Especially
and
health
contamination.
And water. This type of process, which is called in situ leaching, requires a lot of fresh water that becomes contaminated. And so that leaves a legacy of polluted water. And oftentimes these multinational corporations come in and leave us with the bag. And we've got to clean it up with using our tax dollars and our capital. So it's really a mess in the end.
And they're still cleaning up many of the sites from years ago to the tunes of millions of dollars, right?
It's a terrible legacy. And, we haven't had a uranium mine opened, a new mine, in 30 years in the state of New Mexico. And we hope to keep it that way. There's no reason to reopen this ugly Pandora's bag.
So let's tell people one more time the email address if they would like to comment one way or the other to the Forest Service, their environmental impact statement. And that email address is?
It's comments-southwestern-cibola, C-I-B-O-L-A, at fs.fed.us. Or the easiest way to do this is go to the wildearthguardians.org website and go to our Take Action tab. And under Take Action, you'll see a very easy alert where you just have to click a couple times and you will send a letter of your opinion opposing the Roca Honda uranium mine to the Forest Service. So you don't even need to write your own letter exactly. You can customize our letter for yourself. So again, that's wildearthguardians.org and go to the Take Action tab.
And you can also go to their barbecue this afternoon and talk and get more information about this. Because, I mean, there was a wonderful article in the Albuquerque Journal, but we haven't heard a lot of talk about it otherwise. It seems to have slipped under the radar.
It is, but it's getting a lot of attention. There's a very interesting group called the Multicultural Alliance for a Safe Environment that is an alliance of indigenous people and others that are fighting this project tooth and nail. You mentioned some other groups like the New Mexico Environmental Law Center is taking this on. So it's going to meet a lot of resistance. It'll be a long fight, but we're up for it, as always.
Well, Brian, we're going to have you back to talk about some of the other campaigns in depth and to hear a little bit about what comes of this. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you,
we're going to take one more short break and then speak with Cindy Kahn, the Executive Director of Creative Santa Fe, about another big event this weekend, the Fantasy Festival. Welcome to the Radio Cafe. I'm Zaylee Pollan, sitting in for Mary Charlotte, and I'm here with Cindy Kahn, the Executive Director of Creative Santa Fe, and she's here to talk about a big event this weekend, the Fantasy Festival. Welcome, Cindy.
Thank you, Zaylee.
So tell us about this festival.
So Creative Santa Fe decided to partner with the City of Santa Fe and Surroundings, which is a landscape architecture firm, to reopen the DeVargas Park and Skate Park this Saturday from 3 p.m. to 11 p.m. What happened was Creative Santa Fe's overall mission is to function as a backbone organization to bring groups together to really look at larger strategic plans to make an impact on Santa Fe's creative economy. And so we saw the development of this park as one opportunity to really highlight downtown walkability and community collaboration. To that end, we have over 90 community partners who are participating in this event this weekend. It kicks off with the Rodeo to Santa Fe Parade at 3 p.m. They will end at the DeVargas Park, which is between Guadalupe and Sandoval. The Mayor Koss will be getting off a horse and doing the ribbon-cutting ceremony. We have partners, everything from the Santa Fe Opera will be singing, NDI will be performing, the Santa Fe Community College will have a fashion show. We have 10 local bands, we have food trucks, a beer garden by the Cowgirl. It will be an entire day and evening event of community celebration and just really looking at what happens when a community comes together for a shared vision. We also got a grant from New Mexico Arts, and we're able to give 4 grants to local artists to do light and art installations in the park that day and evening, looking at what might happen if Santa Fe started looking at doing an international light festival in our community as an off-season festival, which the city has been very interested in doing in our community.
So let's back up a bit and talk about Creative Santa Fe and the birth of it. It really is to generate arts as business here in Santa Fe.
Absolutely. The basic premise of what Creative Santa Fe is looking to do is to strengthen the creative economy. What we realized is that there really was not one single organization in our community, either nonprofit or private sector or within the government, that function as a backbone to oversee large projects, really get groups to work together, shared vision, and then help attract new types of funding, either from national grants or new streams of funding from private philanthropists who are very interested in funding larger projects that show community-wide collaboration and a shared vision.
And since Creative Santa Fe began, I mean, have there been results in terms of impacting Santa Fe's economy through the arts?
Absolutely. Creative Santa Fe started in 2005 as the result of a city study that was commissioned by UNM to look at Santa Fe's creative economy. It turns out we have a $1.1 billion economy, and the city felt that there needed to be an organization to really steward the vision for keeping that economy robust and keeping the vision alive and continuing what was already happening and all the great things that were happening, but getting them to work together. So over the years, Creative Santa Fe really helped facilitate the purchase of the College of Santa Fe campus, which then enabled it to continue to be a 4-year college. They did a lot of work down at the community college, and they've done a lot of projects. And then in 2011, the team we currently have in place, myself, Laura Carpenter, who's our creative director, Chris Wadeen, who is our community action director, Mayo Miller, Caitlin Peer, and our board chair, Bill Miller, really started to reinvigorate the mission of Creative Santa Fe and looked at, it's great to have a big idea, but how do we start to really implement change? Mm-hmm. So 2012, we spent bringing in national speakers, experts in the field, and coming together with local experts and people who have been working on really incredible projects over the years and saying, how can we all work together towards shared goal initiatives? And so 2013 started out with 2 main initiatives. One is Connect Santa Fe, which is downtown walkability, and it's also Connect Santa Fe in the network sense. How do we get people to work together, to dream together, and start actually implement projects together? And then the more physical, tangible side of connectivity, which is downtown walkability, bikeability, and really spurring our local businesses and local economy. Our other main initiative is looking at building an arts and creativity center in our community. To that end, we just released a survey. We encourage everyone, any creative person, nonprofit, or small business, to fill out this survey. It's 15 minutes. It'll give us a very clear sense of what type of shared live-work space our community might need and what other resources might be built into that type of space, a shared performance space, rehearsal spaces, entrepreneurship training, office space for small nonprofits. So that survey is available on our website, which is creativesantafe.org, and we really encourage everyone in the creative industry to take a look at that survey and fill it out.
And have you already gotten some responses or some feedback about what is desired by any group here in Santa Fe?
In May, we brought a group called ArtSpace, which is a national foundation that specializes in building affordable creative centers, live work, and otherwise in the United States. We're partnering with them, and so they came out last May. We did a series of meetings, of lectures, of town hall type meetings. Talked to over 200 people during that weekend, and ArtSpace really assessed there was a very big need, and this need has been addressed for almost a decade now in our community. The question has been, how do you actually build this? How do you fund it? And how do you make it so it really suits the needs of our community? So ArtSpace actually owns and operates this building, and so they help spearhead the funding. They also ensure its affordability. And so for an investment the city and Creative Santa Fe and private investors would make for about $1 million, you get a $16, $17 million edifice and building in your community that immediately starts giving back to the community.
And in terms of funding, you mentioned grants and you mentioned this. Is it primarily city-funded or primarily grant-funded?
Entirely privately funded. And we are looking at grants. And again, as I said, one of our key goals is to become a backbone organization that can attract larger grants for collaborative initiatives. For instance, we did a Write an NEA grant this last year. We find out next month for an Our Town grant that's a collaborative grant for this Arts and Creativity Center. So we came together with 8 other nonprofits in our community to apply for this grant. So that's sort of the model of attracting new sources of funding, new streams of funding for larger collaborative projects in our community.
That does seem to be a model throughout in a lot of other nonprofits, or it should be. If they're not using it, then they should be.
It's definitely becoming a national and international model, and so we really want to spearhead that doing it in Santa Fe to bring Santa Fe up to, you know, attract new types of funders. We've all really depended on the same small group of funders in the cultural realm for years, and it's time to really start looking at other ways that we can get major projects funded in our city that to really strengthen our creative economy.
And there's also been a lot of talk, I know, under Bill Richardson about kind of a cleaner economic engine. I mean, we get so much of our economic revenue from oil and gas and development. We just had Brian Bird talking about uranium mining, and this just seems like such a no-brainer that Santa Fe is such a creative city, and really developing that can bring us so much
exactly.
more.
And I think one of the most important things that we focus on is that we already have such incredible assets, and you know, how do you leverage those assets to just continue making Santa Fe a really incredible city?
Well, I hope everybody can go there this Saturday. You all are going to have a busy weekend, June 15th from 3 to 11 at the new DeVargas Park. Thank you so much, Cindy Kahn, for coming and telling us. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Zaylee, sitting in for Mary Charlotte.